sex has nothing to do with this. Sex is the currency for the violence. The violence is overpowering. You are mine. I do with you what I want. And I use shock and fear to neutralize you. And putting sex in front of another person that is not wanted is fear-inducing. It's terror-inducing. It's traumatic. It's traumatizing.
Couples therapist and podcast host Esther Perel. I'll speak with her in a moment about what drives some men to commit abusive and predatory behavior. First, the Weinstein ripple effect keeps rippling. The latest allegations are against a Hollywood agent, Tyler Gresham, who works primarily with child actors. The Los Angeles Times reports today on speaking with 8 young male actors who say they were sexually assaulted by Gresham, many while they were underage. The Times reporter who wrote that story is Gus Garcia Roberts. I spoke with him earlier. First, tell us a bit about Tyler Gresham. Who is he?
Sure. Yeah. So Tyler Gresham, he was a longtime agent for APA, which is a Hollywood agency that's known to be in competition with some of the larger agencies in Hollywood representing actors. And Gresham carved out a niche in over a decade at that agency representing a lot of child actors until he was fired about 2 weeks ago. He had more than 50 clients listed under his name on IMDb. Probably his most prominent client was Finn Wolfhard, who's one of the stars of Stranger Things and is 14 years old. So that was sort of what he was known for, was handling this niche for the agency of actors often under the age of 18.
And Finn Wolfhard, he quit APA, right? And was it because of Tyler Gresham and the allegations against him?
Yeah, so about 2 weeks ago, a filmmaker named Blaise Godme Lippmann made some allegations on Facebook. It was part of the hashtag MeToo campaign, which has gotten steam on social media following the Harvey Weinstein scandal. Mm-hmm. So a filmmaker named Blaise Godme Lippmann said that when he was 17 or 18, Gresham had taken him out to lunch under the auspices of perhaps representing him through APA and, quote, fed him several glasses of wine and then taken him back to his home and sexually assaulted him. And so Blaze put this story on Facebook, and it caused a couple of others to come forward with similar stories. Also, young men in the industry who said Gresham had done similar things to them. And that caused, one of the first dominoes to fall was Gresham's client, Wolfhard. And later that day, APA fired Gresham.
And Wolfhard, just to be clear, has not alleged any abuse by Gresham.
No, Wolfhard, he hasn't spoken to me or his reps about why it is he left the agency, but the timing suggests that it was in response to the allegations against Gresham. But there's no indication that he himself has accused Gresham of anything. Mm-hmm.
But 9 have come forward so far.
At least 9, yeah. 8 have spoken to me, and there's a 9th accuser who is also among 2 who have filed complaints of alleging sexual assault against Gresham with the Los Angeles Police Department. And then there are others that are on social media who have said similar things or said that Gresham was notorious for this sort of conduct.
So, and what is the conduct? What is the pattern? And does it all involve underage boys?
It doesn't all involve underage boys. The accusers of Gresham range from age 15 to 27 at the times of the incident. And it's not the exact same in every case, but there's a distinct pattern, which is young men claiming that when they were seeking representation in Hollywood, either Gresham sought them out or they sought out Gresham. And then when they were under the influence of alcohol, even though in at least 5 of the cases they were not of age to drink, he attempted to make sexual advances on them. Then in many cases, they alleged that he sexually harassed them afterwards. Via text messages and phone calls and essentially wielding his power as a Hollywood agent over them.
Right. And was he saying, oh, I'll get you these roles or you'll become a star if you do this, that kind of stuff?
In some cases, it was extremely explicit. In one case, a man who is now a legal and business affairs manager at Lionsgate claimed that when he was 27 and trying to become an actor, Grasham texted him that if he had sex with him, he would help him get a role. And so in many of the young men that I spoke to, they had similar stories where Grasham was essentially bartering his influence in Hollywood in return for them having sex with him. And sometimes it was implicit and sometimes it was explicit.
Now, you say a lot of people knew about these stories involving him. What about APA? Are they saying they knew nothing about this?
That's the big question to me, is, and I think that's the question in a lot of these emerging scandals, is what do these men, what did their companies and their employers know? So a lot of the accusers say that they think it's impossible that that APA didn't know, just because Grasham's reputation was so widespread. And in fact, I spoke to a couple of former employees of APA who asked that their names not be used so that they would not be targeted for any sort of retaliation. But they both described Grasham's alleged misconduct with young men as common knowledge in the agency. One of them said that she sat near Grasham, near his office, and heard him arranging to have underage clients sleep at his place and talking about giving them wine and weed and massages. So, you know, that's the lingering question, I think, is what exactly did this agency know? They have told me that they did not have any warnings that Grasham was up to this behavior or was reputed to be up to this behavior, and that if they had, they would have taken immediate action.
You know, we've heard a lot about powerful men abusing women, and, of course, the story of children being abused in Hollywood, that is not new, although it's not talked about. Is there a reason for that, why this is so kept up under wraps, so secret?
Yeah, it's this phenomenon that kind of just surfaces every couple of years, and it's pretty horrifying. You know, there's been allegations and there's been proven instances of people in Hollywood, men in Hollywood, who have used their positions to abuse underage actors. I think, you know, part of it is it's very uncomfortable for people to get their minds around. It's so disturbing. It's something you kind of don't want to think about. I think the other thing is a lot of these men are very, very powerful, and they're connected to a lot of money, and they have very good lawyers. And so it's difficult to build a lasting case against a person like that.
Gus Garcia Roberts is an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll talk about the motivations of these men with renowned psychotherapist Esther Perel. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's only been a month since the Harvey Weinstein story broke. It seems like the world has utterly changed in the last month. Practically every day, there are new horror stories of abuse, men in powerful positions brought down, and the growing knowledge that this behavior is not limited to Hollywood or to Washington, that it is everywhere. But why? Is there something mentally wrong with the men who commit these sexual assaults, and even the ones who maybe don't assault but feel free to harass women? Or is it our society itself that's mentally ill? Esther Perel is a psychotherapist who focuses on relationships and sexuality. She wrote the best-selling book Mating in Captivity, and she's the host of the popular podcast Where Do We Begin? And she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, when you look at Harvey Weinstein, him in particular, more than 60 women have come forward with stories of abuse, harassment, rape. It really seems that he was ruthless in his pursuit of them. How do you, as a psychotherapist, make sense of his behavior?
What you have here is a sequence that is not an uncommon sequence by which a man first seduces by the possibility of a rescue fantasy. I shall change your life. I can do wonders for you. And that is positive power that induces a surrender of a certain sort. From my seduction, I begin to make my advances. I still may hope that my advances will be received positively because I have just induced in you a positive anticipation about what I can do for you. Then you're not responding in kind to me, so now I begin to put pressure and I gradually start to experience from power, I shift to control and I shift to demeaning. And now we're going from the compliment to the degradation. And then after that, I abuse you, I use you. And then after that, I may even send you flowers the next day and apologize and just kind of say, I wish I didn't have to do this. But in a way, you forced me to do this and you put me in this kind of a position. It's twisted. It's not an uncommon without even the sexuality. That kind of descent can happen in all kinds of sequences of abuse, be they including the form of sexual abuse and sexual harassment or assault, actually, that this includes or not.
I want to talk a little bit more about what you said at the beginning with this rescue fantasy. Where does that come from? Why do these men think that they need to rescue women?
You like the damsel in distress. The damsel in distress or the damsel who still is beginning or the young ingenue, you discovered her. You're going to make her. It's that kind of rescue fantasy. It is an enormous power trip. I hold the outcome of your life in my hands. That's quite titillating for some people.
And where does that come from? Is it the power that generates that or the man who becomes powerful and he's always had this behavior in him?
There's not one cause that needs to one outcome. You know, you want to look at issues of trauma in the stories of these men. You want to look at if they were bullied. You want to experience if they experienced themselves as disempowered and they promised themselves that one day they would come back. It's one man showing another man what he is capable of doing, using the woman to ascertain his power. It's not only over the woman. The competition is generally between the men. And the woman is the tool by which they can ascertain their control.
I want to ask you about some disturbing similarities, and this is of a sexual nature, so listeners who may have children listening, you might want to be aware of that and maybe turn down the volume. But with Harvey Weinstein, with Brett Ratner, with James Toback, there are these similarities, and other men also have been accused of this, of masturbating in front of these women without their consent, of that particular activity. What is that? Is that a form of rape without rape, or why do these men do that?
This is the shock value. When I masturbate in front of you, I hold you captive. I shock you, I scare you, and my having the ultimate power that I have is the inducing of fear in you. I use this sexual thing because it can instantly create dread in you, and with that you freeze, and I hold you prisoner to my fantasies. The piece of the exhibitionism here is that it implies shock, fear, and power. Sex has nothing to do with this. Sex is the currency for the violence. The violence is overpowering. You are mine. I do with you what I want, and I use shock and fear to neutralize you. And putting sex in front of another person that is not wanted is fear-inducing. It's terror-inducing. It's traumatic. It's traumatizing.
And to a lesser extent, is groping, unwanted, kissing, all of that, does that fall into that same category?
You know, it doesn't really matter if it's the groping or if it's the masturbating in the front. The mechanisms are very much the same. The mechanisms of power, of fear-inducing, of great degradation. And if I degrade you, then I don't have to feel bad about what I do because I've dehumanized you.
Okay, so when you look at all of these stories that are coming out, and it's not just Harvey Weinstein, as I said earlier, and it's not just men in Washington, it's everywhere now to varying degrees. And so when you look at the pervasiveness in culture, isn't it really the culture?
If you look at it culturally, what you know, we know is that by the age of kindergarten, boys are being cut off from their feelings, from their vulnerability, from their connections to others. And they are socialized in terms of control, in terms of autonomy, in terms of self-reliance and individuality. And we have to put those two things together so that sexuality in all societies has often been the licensed language by which men can experience control, but also connection. It becomes the only language through which men can package all kinds of feelings that can never be expressed as feelings. Sex is the stand-in language for all of that. And that's what makes it so cross-cultural, is that the making of masculinity so suppresses the other emotional languages, so disconnects men from their vulnerability and from their needs, that the only language they can use to express any of this is the language of sex.
I wonder if women hearing this, women who may have been raped or otherwise sexually assaulted, might be thinking, I think you're being too nice. You're giving these men a pass by trying to empathize with their traumas, and that in the final analysis, the people who are really hurt the most are the women.
Oh my God. In my life, I wouldn't think that this is a way to condone or to... Every woman who has had boys can understand what we do when we try to raise men and how we make men be cut off. That is not a pass. That is an attempt to understand what we can do to change this. If we're going to change the behavior of men, we're not going to be doing it just because we're going as accusers after all the criminals. And we're not going to change it only just by law. We're going to change it by having a different education and a different process of socialization of men. So if you're going to change a norm, you need some level of understanding.
And do you feel like we're at that moment now? We're at an inflection point? Because, of course, these stories are as old as time itself. And the subjugation of women is worldwide and has been around since the beginning of time.
Yes. And I think that things have changed. And then again, a little bit. And then again, a little bit. None of these things change fundamentally. Yesterday, I sat with Anita Hill, which was an extraordinary moment to just remember what happened during the Clarence Thomas hearings and why at that time she was just completely discredited and vilified and rendered totally nil. And one of the things she was talking about was the difference is not the accused. The difference is in the experience and in the power of the accuser. This is maybe why there is a moment now where something can change. Because you need women who have power to be able to take on the men who have power. I think that behaviors change. I think we socialize differently with the ages, and there are incremental shifts. I don't think this will become a new revolution, but I do think that one of the things that is very important, for example, is to, you know, if you take another example, drunk driving, it also is something that needed a normative change. So what happens? How do you make it happen? By holding people accountable over others so that one man tells another man that isn't cool. And it isn't just the women who have to tell this in self-defense the whole time. And then you create new forms of social control whereby the people from the same group look at each other and say, no, we don't do this. And then you become isolated if you do it. And this is what happens here again in this situation with Weinstein as well, is that we can go for the bad person and the bad apple, or we can look at the collusion, the bystanders, the silent tacit approval that goes around it. What you change is first the context. You make the context not welcoming of this kind of behavior. You make the context actually very controlling of the non-welcoming nature of this, so that the people who then do this begin to stand out, and then you can go for the apples. But if the apples are in a context where everybody else is a similar apple, you can't really even highlight them.
So I guess given all of this, given the fact that this is dominating our conversations and women are now looking at their own personal lives maybe differently now, and maybe men are as well, how do we get back to a feeling that we can trust one another, either personally or in a larger societal way?
Look, I'll give you an example. I held a town hall this week in New York with about 200 young men and women of all walks of life. Women read and shared experiences of rape, of the consequences in their own families about it, of being sex workers, of going to the police, of going to the emergency room. Men shared experiences of grabbing women, thinking that they were being playful, realizing that the woman did not experience it as playful at all. I think there are plenty of men out there who want to know how to talk to their other men, to their fellows, when this happens, who want to have women be more outspoken at them so that they can actually break out of the code and be more attuned, simply. Part of what I work on is to create the conversations about the unspoken. It's pretty much the majority of my work. And that involves sexuality, relationships, intimacy, no connections. This is what happened in this town hall. It was riveting. And I know that I want to do a part two. It has to continue, and it needs guidance of educators that can structure this and calm and create reassurance in those exchanges, because they can fly off the handle at any moment. The amount of pain that is in the room, and the pain, by the way, is not only on the side of the women. And that's where it becomes important to see how boys have learned certain behaviors. And again, this is not to give anybody a pass, but if we don't know how they learned it, how can we help others not learn it and help those who learned it unlearn it?
Esther Perel, she's a psychotherapist and host of the podcast Where Should We Begin? Her latest book is called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. Esther, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, LAist is out of business, what that means for local news here. And we'll have our regular Friday film reviews, including another movie from the Marvel Universe, Thor Ragnarok.
This feels like it's ripping off films like Flash Gordon and Ice Pirates and Space Truckers. Like, someone has a weird set of tastes in sci-fi, and this is an homage to that. And all that stuff I love.
Plus, we'll review A Bad Mom's Christmas, Lady Bird, and My Friend Dahmer next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It has been a rocky year for media here in Los Angeles. Well, actually everywhere. But it's more than last year. The local news business has been uncertain for a long time. Local advertising dollars have dwindled. Attention spans are shorter. And that has spelled bad news for local news outlets. The latest to disappear is the Gothamist Network. And you might have been a reader of LAist. Keith Plocek teaches digital journalism at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, and he's here now. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. Okay, tell us what happened, because it apparently took even the workers there, the journalists, by surprise that LAist and Gothamist and others went dark yesterday.
I mean, basically, this was a vengeful death on the behalf of the owner, Joe Ricketts. A week ago, the New York office voted to unionize, and now, a week later, he's closed down all operations. He did it by redirecting all the articles to a letter from himself, you know, basically saying that this is a business and it's no longer viable, so I'm shutting it down. Originally, people were afraid that he just wiped out the archives. They seem to be back up now. Hmm. But 116 employees are gone.
Yeah, but he didn't say it was because they unionized, because that would be illegal to fire.
No, he made zero mention of the unionization. It's just a convenient, you know, this is the kind of thing in journalism where we would just put two facts together and let people figure out the connection. But, he only bought the company in spring. In the spring, his DNA Info company bought the Gothamist Network. And, you know, he basically just said he couldn't afford to do it anymore. And, you know, in his defense, that, you know, local news is hard to do as far as from a business model. But it seemed like, you know, why would he buy it in spring and then close it down so quickly? It seems odd.
Yeah. Well, I guess he realized he wasn't going to make any money at all. But I guess that raises the larger issue of, can you make money in local news? Because remember those patch sites, those were considered to be the next hope, and those didn't do well.
No, it's tough. I mean, you can get an audience for local news. There's an appetite for it, of course. And, you know, it goes without saying how important it is journalistically to look at these small city council races, to look at these small neighborhood issues. The issue a lot of it comes down to, though, is advertising, because what local news, you know, used to offer was sort of a guaranteed local audience. So in the sense of, say, you're a dry cleaner in Los Angeles and you want to reach people in L.A., you would go to the LA Weekly, you'd go to LAist, or you'd go to, like, you know, these smaller newspapers, and you'd advertise there because there's a reasonable assumption that people reading this are going to be in your market. When you go to the online space, though, we can assume most people reading LAist were in LA, so that still would have made them an attractive place to advertise, or the LA Weekly. But the issue is with a company like Facebook, for example, they have so much of your info. They can tell you, you can say, I only want my ad to run in Silver Lake to men age 19 to 47 who like, you know, the New York Jets. I mean, you can just do whatever you want with, you know, based on their profiles. And that's a much more attractive buy for an ad buyer, because they know they can really, really know who they're targeting. And it's been tough for local news to keep up with that because they can't offer that sense of granularity.
And yet you have local TV news, which people really like. Apparently the ratings show that people tune into local TV news more than they do to any other news source.
No, for sure. That's still, you know, score one for broadcast. People still tune into that. You know, there's talk that it might be aging, but I mean, it's still a very strong audience there. And that's what's made, that's still attractive to companies like Sinclair to buy, you know, to buy our local stations up.
Right. So why does that not translate to online?
I mean, I think it's a different, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think ultimately it just comes down to when people are watching TV, they're watching TV. There's not like a direct competition necessarily for TV. Like on the flip side, like it would be like advertising on a streaming site or something. And that's not really going to give you the granularity. But I think with like something like the business model for print was always, you can give you a local market. And then also on top of that, another thing is the classified ads. We used to have local publications used to get a lot of money. You know, you had to pay $10 whenever you wanted to sell your lawnmower. You had to pay $10 to list your garage sale. You had to buy a newspaper to look for a job. All that's been replaced with these free sites. So that kind of always sort of buttressed the industry. And TV didn't really have that same model. They were sort of based more on viewers, and so they still have those viewers. Mm. So they're lucky in that respect.
Okay, so recently the LA Weekly, that's been sold to a buyer that we don't know much about, Seminole Media. We don't really know the future for LA Weekly. And earlier this year, LA Magazine was sold along with three other regional magazines for $6.5 million. And staff members, including the editor-in-chief, laid off. So what, when you look at the landscape of local media here in Los Angeles, and at least when it comes to print and online, what do you see?
I mean, it's a bit grim, to be honest. I'm a little concerned. The funny thing is, the irony of this whole Ricketts situation is I used to joke with people that, you know, what journalism needs is like beneficent billionaires to just buy our sites and own them for, you know, kind of a prestige thing, just so they can own a newspaper, kind of like, you know, maybe Bezos and the Washington Post. But, as we've seen here, that, you know, we have a beneficent billionaire who shut down the sites after 6 months or so. But, you know, it is a bit, I mean, it's distressing because, you know, the LA Weekly sale, for example, I mean, we don't even, that's a mysterious sale in itself. And I used to work there for years, and I actually know the people probably, you know, I'm friends with some of the people, you know, in upper management who would have made that sale, but like, we still don't even know who that person is. All we know is they're connected to a pot lawyer, perhaps, like a medical marijuana lawyer.
Yeah, it's very mysterious.
Yeah, and it's like, even like, I mean, not to diss my friends, but it's also like even the rollout of that sale was strange. They should have, you know, normally you would announce who it is and, you know, pretend like you're excited about it, but they were just sort of like, oh, by the way, we sold it to these people and bye-bye. But so... Yeah, but it just ultimately, we have to see what they're going to do with it. Hopefully they want to keep it alive for whatever reason they want to keep it alive. A lot of the other local places, they seem to be kind of slowly contracting, which, you know, is sort of what's happening to a lot of the industry. But the LAist one was, I think, especially distressing because it was just so sudden, just going to cut the cord.
So you teach at USC School for Communication and Journalism. So what do you tell your students about the world they're entering?
I feel like I give them a healthy dose of skepticism because they're reporters. So that's the number one thing we need to teach them. I basically teach, I try not to sugarcoat it. You know, they're going into a rough landscape. We try to give them a diverse range of skills, though, that will ultimately suit them, no matter what the industry looks like down the road. That's why we have some sort of a focus on, multimedia, focus on digital. So, if they end up doing, a lot of them will come to us because they want to do long form text, and we help them with that. But at the same time, we make sure they also know how to do, web videos for social media and how they have basic skills. We try not to sugarcoat the fact that, and they see it, and we actually have like Facebook groups of different students hang out on, and they were actually, they're posting about LAist. They were posting about Teen Vogue, losing its print edition. Like they're mm-hmm. very well aware of it, and bless them for charging forward anyway. Like I've got a lot of respect for that.
All right, Keith, fight the good fight. Thank you so
Thank
much.
You. You too.
Keith Bocek teaches digital storytelling at USC School for Communication and Journalism. Coming up on this program, it is movie time. We're going to review new releases, including the new Greta Gerwig film, Lady Bird, and its polar opposite, another Marvel movie, Thor, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Friday, time for movie reviews this week. Surprise, surprise. A new superhero movie, the latest from the Marvel comic universe. And here to talk about that movie and a couple more is Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast The Canon. Welcome back.
Hello.
And William Bibbiani, host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon. Welcome
Hello.
Back to you.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Great to have you. Okay, let's begin with a movie to get us into the holiday spirit because, after all, Halloween behind us, so we need to start thinking about the next few holidays. Kristen Bell, Mila Kunis, Catherine Hahn are back for A Bad Mom's Christmas.
I actually just wanted to enjoy Christmas this year.
You're a mom. Moms don't enjoy, they give joy.
She's going to keep treating you like this until you fight her.
Physically?
I don't want you to meet my mom.
Now watch me.
Christmas is supposed to be fun.
Say Christmas back.
No more perfect gifts, no more perfect decorations, no more perfect anything.
Okay, Amy, you saw this one. And the bad moms are in this.
Yes.
No, good, fun.
You know, the bad moms franchise, I suppose I can call it now that we have two of them, has this really conflicting thing in the pit of my stomach where you have these amazing comedians. You have Kristen Bell, Mila Kunis, Catherine Hahn, and here you have their mothers, Cheryl Hines and Susan Sarandon and Christine Baranski. They're all so incredible in a movie where the script is so insulting on every fundamental
that's
level.
That's so disappointing.
It really is. You're watching this and they're at the top of their game. They're all doing masterful work in a movie that has the theme that when women are alone, they just turn into dudes who are really only interested in drinking shots in slow motion and and making fun of everything underneath people's pants. I don't know what I can say on the radio, but most of what's in this movie you probably can't say here.
Yeah, who is that for then?
I'm not sure. I mean, the writer-director of the original Bad Moms have returned, and it's two straight married fathers. They both did The Hangover. They came to this franchise from that and from doing rewrites on movies like 27 Dresses. So they've kind of carved out this niche of being the guys who make these out there female comedies, but they don't seem to bear any resemblance to what really is female comedy. You know, it's just kind of male mentality female comedy. But there's bright spots in it, I want to say. I mean, there was a moment.
Well, there's Catherine Hahn.
There's Catherine Hahn, who is playing, she's back playing a spa waxer, and she does get to wax a man who's participating in a sexy Santa contest, and he is terrifically funny. And that scene is, it's done with him on his back pulling his knees up to his head. You can picture that, I'm sure. Mm. And, you know, I was cackling and then also sort of mad at myself. And I feel mad at myself about this whole franchise because I want to see it make money so that we get more movies with these amazing, hilarious women. I just don't want it to be this movie.
Right. You want it to be female-centered with female comedy. That's funny.
Exactly. Exactly.
Is that too much to ask?
No. And we've had a lot of movies this year, like Girls Trip, which was also really funny. But these are also movies directed by men. And I would just want to see us let women really tear these parts apart and chew it up and make us laugh.
Okay. Let's move on to... This is a real duty movie. Looking at you, William. This is Thor Ragnarok. Chris Hemsworth is back as Thor. Tom Hiddleston back as Loki. Here's a clip.
It was made from this special metal from the heart of a dying star. And when I spun it really, really fast, it gave me the ability to fly.
You rode a hammer?
No, I didn't ride the hammer.
The hammer rode you on your back?
No. I used to spin it really fast, and it would pull me off the...
Oh, my God. The hammer pulled you off?
The ground. It would pull me off the ground, up into the air, and I would fly. Every time I threw it, it would always come back to me.
Sounds like you had a pretty special and intimate relationship with this hammer, and that losing it was almost comparable to losing a loved one.
It's a nice way of putting it.
Okay, what are they talking about, William?
They're talking about Thor's enchanted hammer, Mjolnir. The Thor franchise is a weird franchise by any standard. It's a weird hybrid of high fantasy and highfalutin sci-fi. And the characters are bizarre, and it's the costume design is delirious because it's all inspired by Jack Kirby at his strangest. And it's a lot of fun, and I feel like sometimes that's kind of a dirty word when we talk about superhero movies. It's just fun. And I think for once, it almost... feels like it is a dirty word, because although Thor Ragnarok is a very entertaining time at the movies and we could all use a nice little distraction right
now,
and there's some beautiful work in here and some of the performances are great and the production design is fantastic, there's this frustrating tendency it has to set up this really important dramatic moment. People live and die and worlds explode. Everything huge happens. It's a huge epic story. Ragnarok literally means the end of the world. And every time something important happens, they brush it aside with a little joke, and you can't really feel that emotional heft. And it keeps a good movie, and it's a good movie, and I recommend it. It keeps a good movie from ever being great, and it could have been so great.
It's got Idris Elba, Anthony Hopkins, mm-hmm. Cate Blanchett. I mean, some great actors in there.
Many of them are barely in it, though. Idris Elba has a bigger role than he used to in the other films in the series, but it's still not in it that much. Anthony Hopkins isn't in it that much. Cate Blanchett, however, she doesn't have that much to do except look cool and sound cool.
She's the villain,
but she looks so cool the entire time. She is, like, awesome.
I mean, it's also got somebody who I think is going to be the next, like, big movie star. It's got Tessa Thompson in
here.
Oh,
she's so great.
She played the girlfriend in Creed. She was in Dear White People, the film. And here she plays Valkyrie, this alcoholic ex-Valkyrie. I guess her name is just Valkyrie after her own self, who fled from Cate Blanchett and is now sort of befriending Thor, but also is just kidnapping him and selling him to Jeff Goldblum to be a gladiator. Mm. Thor is my favorite of the Marvel characters because he's just a lunatic, like you were saying. And we have Taika Waititi, the director who did What We Do in the Shadows. He's a comedian.
And Flight of the Conchords.
He's doing this film, and it has a feel that is so unlike the usual blockbuster, where it feels so improvised on set. He said that 80% of the dialogue in Thor was improvised, which I think is maybe a stretch.
Really?
But it has this tone that you're not used to, of people kind of ambling, making strange jokes. It feels very him, which is refreshing because so many of these Marvel films have felt really cookie cutter. It feels like it's doubling down on just the nerdiness and weirdness of Thor. The music is 70s metal.
Yeah. You know,
it doesn't feel like it's trying to be cool or like it's trying to be the parallax view like they were trying to say that Captain America was. This is for geeks. And I guess I'm a geek because I thought it was great.
I think there's this tendency a lot of big budget movies have sort of follow in the path of something else. And when you have something like Star Wars or Star Trek, which really define what we think of as big, giant, spacefaring sci-fi adventure stories, that's fine. A lot of people repeat that. This feels like it's ripping off films like Flash Gordon and Ice Pirates and Space Truckers. years. Like, someone has a weird set of tastes in sci-fi, and this is an homage to that. And all that stuff I loved. I just wish that when it sold a big, emotional, important moment, of which there are many, it had taken a moment to actually let us feel it and then moved on with the jokes. But it's a quibble, honestly. It's a really entertaining film, and I would recommend it to
anybody.
And this
is the movie that's going to be the movie this weekend.
I would be very surprised if it isn't. Like, it's okay. It's kind of a big deal.
Okay, moving on to a smaller movie. This one's called Lady Bird, and it's Greta Gerwig's directorial debut. It stars Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf.
I hate California. I want to go to the East Coast.
I want to go where culture is, like
How
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire,
well,
where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Okay, that's when she just opens the car door and jumps out. Amy, what did you think? You saw this one.
I loved this film. I am so excited for people to see Lady Bird. I mean, people know Greta Gerwig as an actress, but this film really proves that she has the terrific gift of being a director. You know, Lady Bird is loosely inspired. She really doesn't want to say totally inspired on her own life as a girl growing up in Sacramento who wanted to move to New York and be an artist, which she did. And it's about the relationship between Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf. And people know Laurie Metcalf from Roseanne probably first. She's so terrific in this.
She's also in
really
A Doll's
amazing.
House on Broadway recently.
She's an amazing actress. And I really feel like Lady Bird shows that she's right up there with the Frances McDormands of the world. I mean, it's a terrific job she does being this mother to a teenage pink-haired girl who's desperate to prove that she's special, changes her name to Lady Bird to try to be unique, and yet can't figure out anything that makes her special at all. I mean, this is a really great coming-of-age film.
And Greta Gerwig, I just want to say, can we just flat out call her a national treasure now? Because I think she's a really captivating performance, and she's been writing brilliantly for a long time. Like, she co-wrote A Mistress America, which I thought was one of the more underrated independent comedies of the last few years. She's very intelligent.
And Frances Ha as well.
Yeah. I love everything she does. And good for her.
I saw this movie, and what I loved about it is it is a love story between a mother and a daughter. And it is so well played and so moving without being treacly.
It is. And I think it's because Greta Gerwig has this brilliant eye to look for the small moments in here. Lady Bird is a girl who likes to go out and buy like crazy thrift store dresses and wear them to parties. And you just get this glimpse of her mother late at night, this mother who she thinks hates her and doesn't understand her, mending her dresses to make them fit her better. And that's the kind of just moment where you really realize this bond that they have. And she's thoughtful enough to put those things in. I mean, this film is funny and it's really agonizing to watch and it's really truthful. I think it's just announces Greta Gerwig as maybe one of our next great directors.
Wow. Okay. Finally, we're going to move on to My Friend Dahmer. This is the origin story of serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer.
I see things in you that I don't like about myself. I want you to have friends in ways that I never could.
I thought you stopped.
Dad always told me what to do, just like you, just like you.
I like bones. It interests me what's inside.
God, Dahmer, you are such a freak!
Ooh, okay, yes, that's putting it mildly. William, this is based on a graphic novel written by one of his high school friends.
Yeah, so Jeffrey Dahmer, before he was a serial killer, he was a high school student. And I think that there is a tendency when you do a story like this, I don't know, you want to like see it through a lens. Like when I found out it was even called My Friend Dahmer, I was like, this is going to be another one of those stories that's about a really interesting person, but the protagonist is actually the really boring person who knew them. This is about Jeffrey Dahmer. And what's really fascinating about it is that it doesn't necessarily have sympathy for him, but it makes his youth so specific, so real. And it really makes you feel like you're in high school with him, with just this weird kid. And maybe you see the red flags, of which there are many. Maybe you just see this odd boy on the sidelines, desperate for attention. And I'm kind of in love with it for that. I love the way that it kind of looks at this kind of objectively, but makes me really feel like I'm in the world with him. And it is horrifying for that reason, but I think it's utterly fascinating.
Do you want to be in that world? You're so in it that the director shot it in Dahmer's real childhood home.
Wow, I didn't know that. I've read the graphic novel, and this really does a great job of picking up on that 70s vibe. You really feel like you're in the surroundings. What to me really stands out about it is that the writer, Durf Backdurf, who's told the story, he does not let himself off the hook for wondering what he did to help shape Dahmer. Because what happens here in the film is you get the things you're expecting to seeing a kid pick up roadkill, be really fascinated in bones. But then what you see is him become this unofficial mascot of the weird kids at school. They think he's hilarious and they take him into their friend group, but really just to kind of make fun of him and use him as a prank. I mean, he's the Pepe the Frog of this high school. And the protagonist, who really helps make him into a joke in a way and gives him the strange power on campus, doesn't let himself off the hook for thinking, what did I do to really push him over the edge?
Yeah, although plenty of people who are bullied don't turn out to be serial killers.
Of course, and that's true. But I do think that if this film has a significance, I think, beyond just, oh, how fascinating what Jeffrey Dahmer was like in high school, is that it can hopefully open your eyes and make you look at the people around you, because that's the thing with serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer. Everyone says, oh, we had no idea.
Yeah.
And a movie like this, where you just plunk down into the reality of living in a culture and in a community with a burgeoning serial killer, hopefully you can look at that and just go, should I be reaching out more? Don't we have a responsibility to sort of keep an eye out and protect people and make sure people get the help that they need and not take advantage of them for our own ends? And you're right. The original writer of this, who did indeed live with Jeffrey Dahmer, yeah, he really seems to find himself culpable. And I admire that a lot.
All right. We have some good movies to see this week.
It's a pleasant turn of events.
Solid group, except for Bad Moms, apparently.
Well, okay. Watch that and Lady Bird together and then really think about what difference a female director makes.
Nice.
Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast The Canon. William Bibbiani, host of the Cancel Too Soon podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Yourself?
Good. So, you talked earlier about the LAist going out of business.
I did.
And, of course, the Weekly was bought as well recently. So, I asked our Twitter followers where they get their local news these days and whether they can find good local news. And it's interesting. I got a bunch of, like, people retweeting and liking and so on, but very few actual responses. And I choose, Madeline Brand, to read into that people care, but they just don't have a lot to point to in terms of local news. Author James Tugend pointed out that The Weekly was also sold years ago to The Village Voice, and he writes, I imagine the right wing doesn't want anything leftist out and around. Of course, we still don't know who bought the LA Weekly. All the people who work there don't know who they work for, which is kind of a strange situation to be in.
Yeah, they're still working there, but they don't know for how long. It's very confusing.
Not a good situation.
And confusing.
There is still, however, the LA Patch.
Really?
Yes. And I went on the LA Patch this morning just to see what's happening at the LA Patch. And do you know what I learned, Madeline Brand?
No. Please, enlighten me.
I learned that Yasiel Puig's home was burglarized during Game 7 on Wednesday.
Really? Yeah. Interesting.
That's terrible.
That is.
That's really
He's
sad
stuff.
He's a hometown
stuff. Hero.
Yeah, he got burglarized back in March, too.
Oh, wow.
Which, thieves got away apparently with like $170,000 in jewels and jewelry and other stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
So I guess
he's not having a great year now.
It just seems really unfair, doesn't it? Like to have to lose Game 7 and then come home and find that all of your stuff has been taken?
Yeah. Yes, it does definitely rub salt in the wounds. Okay, well, thank you, Christian Bordahl, for that local news update. And I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I will see you tomorrow.